Core Samples is really a unique book. You note that it isn't an explanation of science concepts or a guide to political procedure, even though there are aspects of that throughout. How would you describe Core Samples to someone?
Sometimes I describe it as unprofessional writing about professional topics. And it is, it's like there is this, the expectation of a book about science doesn't feel like it anticipates the book. And one of my big concerns is that people will assume this is something that is going to be hard or boring or technical before they even open it. And I've been on this book tour and doing events with a lot of people in the places I go. So I was in Montana and I had a conversation at a book event with a person who works at a local nonprofit focused on climate change. And she said that afterwards, she was like, I was kind of dreading this because I'm not a scientist and I didn't want to read this book. And she's like, and then I opened your book and I saw there are a number of curse words in the book. And so she said, I saw that the F word a few times, and suddenly I felt very comfortable. And then it was really easy to read your book. I mean, I also worry about turning people off because I have curse words in the book too. I don't want anybody to be uncomfortable. I wanted the book to be accessible.
And I think you did a really good job with that. In fact, one of the things that really struck me reading through this is how you bring out the side of science that I've never thought of. Your book really shows that there's a poetry to science, and that's just beautiful. You do this with the way you write and the observations you make about the earth and the connections you make with our lives in nature. I'm so curious when this connection first occurred to you as a person.
I identified myself as a writer when I was 10. I'm one of many children. I have six siblings. I like to spend time in my closet because it was like how to be alone, like you go into a room and then go into a closet and close the door. So I'd write on the floor of my closet. And I remember coming out and kind of announcing, like, I'm a writer. And so that was with me before I thought of myself as a scientist. So the writing was always there, but I did. From early on in college, when I decided that I was going to study geology, I found myself processing the concepts and terms in like a human way. So learning about Earth history is recorded in rocks and in sediment. And there's this question of, are things laid down slowly over time? So you're kind of recording everything that happens and it's this continuous record and it looks like a layer cake. Or is it just the extreme violent events? It's like the earthquakes and the floods, and those erase everything else, and that's all you have. And I remember learning that and being like, what is a life? Like, is my life and my identity, is it this like sort of slow collection of moments, or is it the extreme stressful ones? And so just, these concepts of science always felt like they were helping me kind of understand my life. And that they could be metaphors for life. And so I think the poetry is there where it's both, I want to understand the world and I'm confused about who I am and what it is to be a human, and I want to understand that. So it's like they were in a dialogue with each other.
How did you know that you wanted to get into, of all the sciences, geology?
I never thought of myself as a science kid. I went to inner city public schools in Providence, Rhode Island, and I have a whole bunch of siblings, and the sciences were not good there. When I took chemistry, we didn't have enough textbooks to take them home, and the fume hoods didn't work, so we couldn't do any of the labs. So I really didn't have like a sense of even what it was to study science. I read a ton. I didn't read books about science. I was reading fiction. And when I got out of high school, I got a job in Italy being an au pair. And I went to Italy, and it was in a pretty rural landscape in the Apennine Mountains, and there had just been these huge earthquakes. So I was very struck by the profound impact of earthquakes. People were living in tents. There was a huge Red Cross village, kind of like a shanty town that people were living in. There was scaffolding on all the buildings. So I could see, like, oh my gosh, this is huge. And I realized I had no idea why some places had mountains, others didn't, some places had earthquakes. And I felt just terribly ignorant, like that I didn't understand the landscape, and I could see how much it was a part of people's lives and cultures and stories. And so, really, the idea of studying science was that in order to understand people, I needed to understand the land that they lived on. And it really came in kind of a eureka moment of like, oh my gosh, I do want to go to college, and this is what I'm going to study.
So a lot of your professional work does seem to be geared towards climate science. How did you make that shift towards more that more specialized area?
Yeah, so when I was studying geology, I wanted to get involved in research and that the building of knowledge and new knowledge and asking questions. And I was learning about the impacts of climate change, and I wanted to understand how the changes in climate would impact somebody's human life, because so much of the information was like, over, 100,000 years, the average temperature of the ocean has changed 2 degrees Celsius. And it's like, well, what does that mean? And I got really interested in like, what is the human timescale of these changes? How can we study that? And that's how I came to Minnesota, which is I came for graduate school to study lakes. And lakes are really good archives collecting information on a timescale of like a human life about changes in the landscape and changes in the climate. So it was really like reconstructing how did past changes in climate happen? What did that look like? And then that helps us predict and inform climate models for the future.
This is what we're reading, and we're talking with Minnesota writer Anna Farrow Henderson. Her new book is Core Samples: A Climate Scientist's Experiment in Politics and Motherhood. Anna, in one of your essays, you mention the incredible amount of work that went into carrying out some of your field research, but when it came to writing up that research into articles for scientific and peer-reviewed journals, you said that while I erase myself from scientific discoveries, I can bring my whole self into creative writing. And I just found that so interesting because, as a librarian at a university, we really try to reinforce how scientific research is reliable because it is done so in a way to remove bias, to remove the person from it, and just focus on the science. Do you think that students would get more value if there was more of the story of how the work was done, more of the self in that scientific literature?
I think it's really beautiful to be able to have both. So you have here is the science reported out, this is information. And for people to be able to feel like that's accessible, they're able to read that research and go into it. I mean, even now that I'm not in active research, I love that I can read a scientific paper. If I want to learn more about a medical condition, I might read a medical paper, which I don't have a background in, but I understand why it's written the way it is. But at the same time, I think it's really compelling to understand the broader context of the work. I mean, people love adventure stories, and every scientific field expedition is an adventure. And if we don't tell people about the adventure, how will they see the wonder? It's like a little bit like we kind of take the wonder and excitement and adventure out of the science, and then we're like, science is so great. Don't you want to study science? So I think there's that pairing, and it's also for a student. I think, it's so valuable for a student to have an experience reading scientific information, but also doing science, to participate in a research project, to go out to a lake and to help take samples and see those results and understand what they mean about the place where they live or another place in Earth. But if they're able to then process that experience in another way, like maybe they're a cello player and maybe they compose a song that's about Lake Bemidji, and then it's this integration of information, because science at the end of the day is just information, and what we do with it and how we use it is a whole other thing. And I think sometimes we're missing that integration part. And kind of in my experience of, I worked as a scientist and then I worked in politics, and in politics and policy making, you're figuring out how to apply all this information, but most people don't have the background and context of that information. So it's sort of like you have these two extremes where there's like experts generating information, but not delving into how do we integrate this or what do we do with it. And then you have people who are deciding what we do with information who don't really know anything about the information. And I think for students to be able to like move between those is really powerful.
You just mentioned how you worked in politics, environmental policy making, and in the book you talk a little more about working with Senator Al Franken and Governor Mark Dayton on environmental policy. What was that transition like for you, though, from being a scientist, hands-on in the field, to coming indoors and sitting down at the table and trying to create policy?
So I didn't come from a political family. I didn't have much experience in politics. And when I left the lab, hung up my lab coat and went to DC to work in the US Senate, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing or what this would be like. I didn't take classes in policy in college or anything like that. So I came in and I kind of thought, like, I don't belong here. And what am I doing here? And within about a week, I was like, oh my God, I was made for this place. So I felt like there's a whole, you know, all of us are a spectrum of different kind of personality traits and skills. And when I was in science, I was using a narrow set of those. I had very little use of my personality or, you know, skills like talking or explaining things. Most of the time I was just like working by myself in a room alone. And in politics, everything was like, you're interacting, you're talking, you're writing things. The things you're writing are going to be said on the Senate floor. They're going to be said in a hearing. They're going to be in a headline. They're going to be in an interview. And this like immediacy and need to like think on your feet, the urgency of everything that was happening, the high consequences, it felt like, oh my gosh, I'm like finally using this part of who I am. And it was so fun. In some ways, I felt like I'd been in this world that was like black and white, and I came out into this world that's in color because everything was on the table. Like we were talking about all the issues, everything was coming at us. And I was using every skill that I had and everything, you know, like personality or learned skill to navigate all this. And it was so intellectual. And it also, I mean, in the transition, like, I was kind of silly. Like I didn't know what I was getting into. And I was like, I'm a scientist who's an expert and I'm going to come and I will make everything clear. And then we will have climate action, you know? And it's like getting there was like very humbling. Like every day in politics is just humbling because it's realizing that like other people don't agree with you. They don't see that what you think is important is important. The thing that you're saying is not coming across. You know, Senator Franken was a huge champion of climate change. He was one of the most outspoken senators at the time on the environment. And yet in the office, every time I brought something up, it was not inevitable that we were going to support it or we were going to do it. Like issues like Keystone Pipeline was really big then. And he didn't come out against the pipeline. And so there was this, it was like humbling to deal with the rest of the world not agreeing with me, but also here I am working for this progressive senator, and it's not a given that he's going to agree with any of the things that I kind of thought were inevitable. And I had to think, I had to learn to think and be empathetic to a lot of perspectives that I didn't know anything about. I grew up in a city. I didn't have experience with like hunting or fishing. And that perspective of like interacting with the environment. So there was like a lot of, it wasn't me as an expert coming and telling people, like, let me tell you about the science. It was really like me coming and listening and being like, oh, wow, there's like a lot I don't know. And I need to take this into consideration.
As a woman in science and as a mother, you stood up against the double standards, the inequities. Women are going to continue to seek professional fulfillment. They're going to continue to have children. What's going to make doing both easier or at least more equitable as we move forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have had the experience of being places and I, as a mother, and it all works and makes sense. And it doesn't feel like I'm somehow asking for special treatment or, you know, something different than other people. And I've been in situations where it feels like everything about being a mother is like, I'm not fitting in. And I really think it's the work culture and kind of the infrastructure of how an office is set up. And it isn't just, I learned the hard way, like you go work for another woman and that doesn't mean that they're going to be supportive or this is going to be a good place for other women or mothers to be. what makes for a good office culture and a good boss is not tied to gender. It's really tied to how things are set up. And I had the experience when I worked for Governor Dayton. I had a boss who was also a mother. Most of my colleagues had young children, and things were set up with the idea that people would need to be home to put their kids to bed, and they would need to have be home with their kids on the weekend, and yet we were expected to be available 24/7. And so we would do things like everybody leaves the office, they go home for dinner, they put their kids to bed, and at 8 o'clock we have a meeting and we're all back on working, which might not sound like great to people, but it allowed for, I was doing both of those and it wasn't a tension. It was built into the system. Or it's the weekend, something's happened, there's an emergency, we need to have a meeting. And it would be like, okay, we're going to meet during nap time. And I mean, all kids nap at different times, but sort of like we're going to meet in the middle of the day, sometime around what might be your kid's nap time. That boss was promoted. We got a new boss who was also a woman, and she was a really great person. But this kind of flexibility, people managing their own schedules. We all traveled a lot. We went to a lot of meetings, so we weren't like at our desk all the time. And she came in and was like, everybody has to be at their desk from 9 to 5 unless you ask me permission. And it was like, wait, I have to ask you permission to go do a meeting for my job? Or like, I have to ask you permission if my kid has an emergency at school. Like, what are you talking about? And suddenly, we went to this really restrictive climate, and people, whether they had, like, not everybody had kids, and some people who didn't have kids, it was like they were just as unhappy. So I think that, like, what makes a good workplace for everybody, like, what makes a good place for women and mothers is going to make the workplace better for everybody else. Because everybody has things in their life. They have people that need help, they have emergencies that come up. And so having some flexibility, having the assumption that people are responsible, having clarity about your work responsibilities so there could be that flexibility and you're able to evaluate whether people are doing their jobs. I think all of that is super important. So I think like we need the assumption that all people have caretaking responsibilities, and this is really important to a healthy workplace that we're able to do those.
Can you talk about what you're doing with your writing? I guess I wasn't clear. Are you teaching writing right now? Yeah.
So, when I left Governor Dayton's office in 2019, I had made the decision that I was going to focus on writing because I realized that if I didn't really take steps to make this a priority, I would never have time. I'd always just be like hiding in my closet, sitting on the floor, writing in a notebook, and never getting beyond the hiding in the closet part. So, like, literally. I got a state art board grant then that helped support me writing, and I did an interactive art exhibit that was up for 3 months with community bookmaking. So ways like I think, writing is kind of solitary, but it is so important to socialize our re writing, our creative process, to talk to other people. So one of the things I've done with that is to do community bookmaking projects. And right now on my book tour, I've been doing a community bookmaking project where I have book plate stickers that I hand out, and they have a design on them, and I ask everybody to write a 7-word memoir about their relationship to nature. And then if they want to, they can put those into this book that I have. So it's like we're all building this book together about our relationship to nature.
Nice.
So that's a way that I'm kind of, it's not exactly teaching, but it's like trying to bring in and share creative process so that we are in community in a creative way together. I teach writing at the Loft Literary Center. I'm not teaching this year because the book tour, I got another grant with the book coming out to do rural book events that are meant to bring art access to folks living in rural communities. And so with that, I've been doing this bookmaking project. I've been teaching classes. Next month, I'll be in Ely and I'm going to teach a zine making class. I've been teaching a lot of classes at libraries because that's a, I'm going, I've been going to places that don't necessarily have a bookstore. And so then the library is the gathering place for people to talk about books and to talk about art, which has been really wonderful. And then this kind of cool thing has happened that I'm loving, which is being asked to teach storytelling to scientists. I gave a presentation to like 70 people who work at the National Science Foundation, and I taught a workshop that was kind of wacky. Like it was a creative writing workshop to cancer researchers at UNC Chapel Hill, and I taught a storytelling class to the R&D team at 3M. So it's been this like this is so that people think it is important and they want to actively learn other ways of communicating and sharing the importance of their work, and they see the role of storytelling and art as part of that is maybe one of the most exciting things about this bookstore. So I've been really, really enjoying that.